So, it's probably quite pertinent that we had discussion of poverty and charity, because when I looked at the story of Dorcas and the situation she was in, I decided there must be a lot more to her than just selling a few clothes, because charity costs money. So, after my last class, people asked me whether I got my ideas from other places or how I put it together. And I thought, maybe with this one, I should, because I didn't get my ideas from hearing other people's talks, I actually get my ideas from being in the garden, and while I'm pottering around, I talk to God about the things in the Bible where the words don't really seem to give, to coalesce into a clear picture for me. So poor God has this rambling interrogation from him that can go for hours. But I do get feedback. It triggers his thinking. So when I decided to do Dorcas as a follower of Jesus, I developed a framework of saying, well, who is she? So her name means gazelle, and she's the only woman named as a female disciple. Where's she from? Well, we don't actually know. How did she come to follow Jesus? We're not explicitly told. Where is she when we read about her? She's at Joppa, and what's she doing there? She's waiting to be buried. So when you sort of go behind the words, there's a lot that we assume from reading a few verses. We think, oh yeah, she's from Joppa, but it doesn't tell us that. So it's through asking yourself questions about the words that you start to get your interest triggered. Does that make sense to anyone else? Yeah. So what nationality was she actually? I did check up some of this, and many commentators say she was a Greek Jew. But this is an assumption. We're not told that. Are there other possibilities? Yes, she could be a Greek Gentile who converted to follow Jesus and who adopted the Aramaic version of her name as a sign of her conversion. She might have been renamed by Jesus himself, as Peter was.
Excuse me, can you tell us which name is Aramaic?
Sorry. Tabitha's the Aramaic and Dorcas is the Greek. I think I could have got it there wrong again. Yes, it is. Tabitha is the Aramaic and Dorcas is the Greek. And the English is Gazelle. So, that's rare in itself. I mean, most women in the Bible aren't named, and if they're named, they're Mary. And we have a great deal of trouble figuring out which Mary, where, when, and how. So, it's unusual that her name's recorded. Usually women aren't named, let alone in two languages. And only Jesus and Peter and Paul have this honour. So that's a bit significant that that slipped through the erasure process. And Paul had Roman and Hebrew names because he was a Roman citizen. How did she end up in Joppa? Need to investigate. Is there a community? That's all right. I have a father with industrial deafness, and all my life I've heard, you're wasting your time, you're speaking into my deaf ear. Go around the other side. And the poor man's probably got neck problems from constantly turning. Where is Joppa, and what is its significance? It's a seaport town with an ancient history and an important role in trade. What's she doing there? We don't know. We only know that while she's there, she serves the ecclesia and the poor in the city. It doesn't seem to be limited to just the Christians or the Jews. Are there many people recorded as being resurrected in the New Testament? No. How many? Three by Jesus. That's not a lot, is it? And one by Peter and one by Paul. So later we might consider how you qualify for resurrection. So she is very important. What does qualify a person for resurrection? Their survival, it seems, has to be essential to the survival of at least one other person, or to the purpose of protecting the preaching of the gospel. Is raising the dead easy? No, I decided that wasn't easy. Are there any similarities between her story and any other story in the Old and New Testaments? Yes. Is she wealthy and influential? Yes. Joppa is a seaport, so does it have a major trading partner? Yes, it's Tyre. Is this a long-established history of trade? Yes, including the reigns of David and Solomon. Will investigating this history and the similar stories in the Old Testament, the other resurrections in the New Testament, and the events recorded in the chapters around the narrative about Tabitha help to give us a fuller picture of the work and purpose and relationships with Yahweh she has, and with Jesus and other disciples and their families? I decided that was a yes. Will it help us to understand her discipleship, to consider what it would have been like to be poor in Joppa at that particular time under Roman rule? Yes. Was there anything about this short story about Tabitha that grabbed my attention because it didn't seem quite right? Yes. What was it? The claim that she'd been ongoingly engaged in good deeds and many charitable works, and she made garments for the poor. Well, charity isn't cheap, as we've been reminded. She had to have income or wealth for this work, and everyone in a port town learns to sew, and all widows can sew. So why would she be making these clothes? It's more likely that she's providing the money or the cloth for these garments. It's most likely that she's the person providing most of the provisions for the poor in the church, if not for the whole church, and administering the acquisition and distribution of goods and services there and possibly elsewhere. The text does not say what her charitable works and good deeds are. And nor indeed does it say her reputation was limited to Joppa or the church. The clothing was displayed as evidence of her patronage. So I looked up the word "maid" in the concordance. And yes, the word is usually translated as provisioning, as in funding projects as a wealthy patron. So, you see, talking to God and saying, that doesn't fit that, can have some interesting results. And if you came to my garden, you'd understand why there's a large expanse of lawn, and the flower beds are all peripheral, and because, you see, I do this lying down weaving. It's the repetitiveness of the weeding that seems to get the leave the brain free to dialogue with God. I know it sounds absurd, doesn't it? But your hands need to be busy for the busy brain to actually settle and focus. Otherwise, the brain seems to just chatter about one subject to another, the shopping, the cooking, it will wander anywhere, won't it? Does anyone else find that if they're doing something, like knitting or something, it actually soothes you and so you can focus? Oh, Annette, you're nodding.
Yes.
Find that?
Yes, I do.
Oh, good.
It's scientifically proven.
Yes. Has it? Yes. Oh, do you want to stop admitting? There's evidence. Okay, usually, yes, and it's usually translated as provisioning, as in funding projects, as a patron, rather than the, in fact, there isn't another case, I think, where it's been translated made, only this case, rather than a narrower and less significant word made, for which another word is usually used. Which does, the use of made does seem to downgrade the status and the influence of the person doing this. And then I thought, well, why would translators do this to Tabitha when apparently they don't do this when the record's about a man? Could there be a touch of gender bias here? Well, the entry in the concordance leads us to suspect that, but why? And does changing the translation broaden the significance of the narrative and the work and the person of Tabitha? Yes. Did it make me look for further and ask all of those preceding questions? Yes, it did. Sorry, I've just got this little dog-eared page here because I have to come back to that page later. So I'm just unravelling it to read the next bit to you. So if we have a feeling something isn't quite right, stop and acknowledge the feeling and ask yourself what you think is odd about the record and check it out. It makes us consider what we are reading. And even if we can't find an answer, an investigative approach to researching will remember that. And when more of bits of info come along, we do connect them. Even years later, I found myself thinking, oh, well, that explains such and such, which I've always wondered about. Do you find yourself doing that? Yeah. Yeah, where did I get to?
Yeah,
Sorry, I've got the aircon in one ear. You're speaking to my...
Oh, sorry, I missed what you said, that we're made. It
should be translated as provisioning, as a patron, a benefactor. You know how in the Roman system, because there was no welfare, it all fell to, it was a sort of obligation, like the Americans have their civics, where you donate money to projects for the poor, and that idea, like Bill Gates did with some of his money he made from computers, and
yeah. Well, I'm very glad of that.
Yes.
I'm very glad of that because we've always had Dorcas classes, and I've always thought of sewing machines and putting together garments. So if you work back in Bible study from Dorcas and what we know of Dorcas, what Dorcas making, doing sewing. That's all I've ever thought.
Yes, that's, to me, that's...
Sewing. Yeah. And sewing machines.
Yes. And that's what... And that's what... I said to myself, It's a seaport for sailors, though. Everyone has to sew in a seaport because sails have to be fixed because sailors are renowned for being sailors.
It's a really good
It's really different, isn't it? And it makes you go back to those few words that says, oh, well, she did charitable deeds. And it made me go, but wait a minute, even if you're doing rap with love, like Julie and many other people, you're buying the wool, you're putting in the time and effort, you're not just knitting, do you know what I mean?
Yes,
so you're not just sewing, and like...
Somebody takes it to the people.
Yes, and I thought, like, I was really pleased that you announced about Jackie and the packs for girls, because like you said, she's financing that, and it would be nice for us to give her some money. So it makes you think behind it all, doesn't it?
It's provisioning.
Yes, yes. And it might be seem only a small provisioning, but it's really important to those people.
And if you aren't a crafty person, you don't have to feel guilty that you're not a dorkish-like person.
Exactly.
Because you can provide for other people to do some of
the crafts.
That's right.
Like knitting.
I don't like sewing.
I was much happier to give Jackie money. And you see, it's the work of getting the goods, isn't it? She pops down to the shops or that. It's all time and effort, and as the Americans would tell us, time is money.
It doesn't mean you do it individually.
No.
You say, but you should, like somebody else actually helped you.
Yes, yes.
But she was the one behind.
Yes, and even if you're doing right with love, you have to get the squares to a centre, where they're then collected to go into the ABC. I don't know if they still sew them up in the ABC premises, but they used to do that. So it's a long chain of administration.
Now, you have to buy a container. You have to buy
a container.
That's the tanner. She would hire one there.
I'm just saying, but to stop sewing.
Did she do the arrangements for getting goods to Canada?
Yeah. Somebody like that attracts people. So you've got, like you're saying, but when you have somebody like, no matter where you are in the world, somebody is this connection. So the suppliers, there's the demand, there's the helpers, the assistants. So people are drawn to help in some way. Well, I can't knit, but I can
sew,
or I can pick it up. So you find, I'm just looking
and even people outside your church community,
the sisters in the Philippines back in the 70s, how that one of the ladies was micro business thing in the best of times. So if somebody gave her $5, she got $6 back.
Right.
And that was her commission. But it was only small amounts of money.
Yeah.
But there was lots of other deeds, you know. That,
yes.
That resulted in a goodwill, you know.
Yes.
I've got a bunch of bananas I can give back.
Yeah.
Everybody in the village who's given me rice over the last month. And so there's this kind of barter. And that trading happens around somebody who was like that.
And then you build up a reputation for being either trustworthy or not so trustworthy. Mm.
And
yes.
And to be a disciple, you know. But to use the two names would be that she's working in two communities.
Well, that's interesting. Yes.
Were you working in dual languages? You know?
Oh, thank you, because that's what I thought, but I didn't have any... I didn't stop to think of contemporary evidence, so that's really good.
Because there's a Portuguese, there's there, and there's Aramaic. So the Aramaic people would call you by that name, they will call you by the other way. So whatever
And with the Bible, as we've seen, when words are changed in translation, you can't be sure that the ordering of the names tells you whether she was born a Gentile or born a Jew. So, yes.
But it puts another dimension to her.
It does.
Instead of this little sewing lady that we've always had in our like this little lady that's that and sew and help people. But she could be a huge organiser of
things.
You know, she might have just
lived
her.
She
becomes a different sort of...
Yeah, combining the skills with the materials to help create what
Because you don't think God can give them another sewer?
Exactly, in a port town, where even the sailors, so I'm going, no, no, there's something wrong
more,
there.
More than
that,
yeah. But I never thought of that. I just thought she was loved because she
was. Yes, and she would have been loved for that, but they've truncated it all to that.
And that is the emphasis.
Yes.
In this story.
It is, it's the on love. The sewing and the love.
The compassion of Christ in action.
Mm. Yes. So exploring the hunch will take us to other biblical and historical records and increase our reading and skills and therefore our learning from the text and our meditation on it and application to our own lives. This is part of the process of how we learn, when we have a need or a prompt to learn. I have to turn over because I woke up in the middle of one night thinking, but I've now got the conclusion for this, and if I don't write it down, it will be gone. So I've got the conclusion bracketed off, and I'm just going over here, but I have to put the dog ears back or I won't know where to end. I then also looked up the word used to describe Tabitha as a disciple, because when you get one feeling something's not sitting right, then you deal with that, and then you go, well, there could be something in this as well. So, the Greek word, I did write out the pronunciation somewhere, but I lost it. Methotria, I think. Do you know, Robert?
I think that's right.
You do, yeah. It's the feminine of methetes, which comes from the word to learn. The feminine is only used once in the New Testament, and that's for Tabitha, and it means someone who is a pupil, a disciple. Both the masculine and feminine forms of the word have the same significance. They indicate that these people have become mathetenuo, which means to have been enrolled as a pupil, to be discipled, instructed and taught. The intransitive of this word is to disciple, to instruct, to teach, which signifies the purpose of their discipleship. Tabitha, I think, was enrolled by Jesus as his disciple to learn his teachings, wisdom, morality and methods, so she could then disciple others in the gospel of salvation in Jesus. Her purpose was to go out to preach, teach, encourage and provide for non-Christians and Christians alike. And the evidence of her discipleship was to be her works of healing and charity, just as the works of healing and charity were the evidence of Jesus' right to teach and preach. Because that's the point of the widows and people gathered around the body with the clothes. They've sent people off. They sent two men off to get Peter and say, come back, because they knew that he had the gift of the Holy Spirit and he could raise people. And when you want, really passionately want someone to do something like that, you get all your evidence together to prove that they are worthy of this demand, because they're begging him, but it's almost like a demand, isn't it? It's, we need her. This isn't a whim. It isn't that we're just grief-stricken with the loss, but this is the evidence that we need this woman back with us. I don't think there's another record of that happening in the New Testament, is there? It's odd. Isn't it interesting that you get just this small bit, and the more you look at it,
that piece you just read out,
yeah.
Really, where did it come from? I don't understand where you got it. Did you research that from somewhere?
Or yes,
did
it come
out of your brain in the middle of the night?
I looked up disciple, and that's what it means. Yes,
right.
My faithful concordance.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
And can I just
mention that disciple is obviously linked to the word discipline.
Mm. Yes.
And that means learning.
Mm. Yes.
Oh. So,
head down, butt up.
That is exactly what you're trying to do. But there's so many words that are related.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a bit overused, isn't it? So that it dissipates, and it, that's why I thought I need to look up what it really means.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And is there really, if you're a female disciple, does it mean that you're only sewing?
Or you keep
quiet, yes. Yes, the noise of the sewing machine should drown any words. Oh, you mean they didn't have 3D printers and you just downloaded a pattern and whipped it up to go?
So it wasn't just the blokes who were doing the learning.
Yes.
Being a disciple is an active thing.
Absolutely.
Yes. So you don't just sit back and be a disciple by just believing in what's being said.
And even when I needed to learn computing, one of my friends said, now we'll just pop along to this room in the university, and pulled out a chair and sat me at the keyboard and got me going and showed me how to set things up. And when we'd done all that, I said, why did you take the time to do that? He said, because if I hadn't told you to go away and start, you would never have done it. And I said, you're right. How did you know? And he said, because I'm exactly the same. And I thought, that's true. It's, you're, as a teacher, you say, right, pens at the ready, you tell them what you want, or you write it on the board, and then you get them doing it, don't you? So this learning is three-dimensional. You practice, you listen, you practice. Christ taught his disciples, and then he would say to them, okay, you're ready? This is your first excursion out into the big world to do these things. So it's yes, thank you for that, because it's not just writing things down. Learning is a very interactive process, isn't it? It can even involve weeding. This could be one reason why the biography of Tabitha is hard to pin down. Where did Jesus live for his approximate 3.5 year ministry? He lived where everywhere he went in Israel and beyond, and nowhere in particular. He didn't have a house. He didn't own property. He didn't own a home. Where did he come from? Geographically, from Bethlehem and Nazareth, with a short stint in Egypt. Spiritually, from God. Where did Tabitha originate? That's yet to be found. Spiritually, she came from Jesus the Christ. Jesus is God saved and the anointed. Tabitha is Dorcas, and in English, the gazelle. The gazelle is the symbol of love and purity in both Hebrew and Persian poetry. It features in the Psalms and the Song of Songs, which is a love drama or a romantic performance dialogue, I think. So the gazelle is in dialogue and interaction with her saviour for the salvation of others. The gospel tells us that Jesus came to seek and save the lost sheep of the house of Israel and shepherd them safely into Yahweh's kingdom. But the leaders of his people and many of the neighbours of his youth rejected him. They didn't want a seemingly ordinary, compassionate teacher to be their Messiah. They wanted a tall, robust military leader, just as the people of ancient Israel wanted a king like Saul, not judges like Deborah and Samuel. So most of the people who sought and accepted Jesus did so because they had an urgent need for healing and had heard of his miracles. Jesus began in his home territory and broadened his itinerary until he had covered all of Israel, including the Decapolis, and preached to Israel's neighbours in Tyre and Sidon, with whom Israel had had long-standing trade and intermarriage connections. He was calling Israelites throughout Canaan and beyond, and proselytizing anyone who, like his ancestor Ruth, would respond to Yahweh's message of salvation. And this is what he was simultaneously teaching his disciples to do. I think Tabitha must have journeyed with Jesus for at least a significant section of his preaching travels. So we don't know how she ended up at Joppa, but Joppa is the main port for supplies for Jerusalem, and it is not a far distance from it. Around the time of Tabitha's story, the Christians were fiercely persecuted by the Jews in Jerusalem, and she could have been among those who fled the city. I suspect Tabitha was among those disciples at the Last Supper, because she's marked as a person of significance by being named as a female disciple, named in Greek and Aramaic, and there is also the fact that the wording for the laying out of her corpse echoes the wording for the location of the Last Supper. Both took place in an upper room. Does that strike anyone else as? We know neither Jesus nor his closest disciples owned houses or property, but many women who were wealthy contributed to their support. Tabitha would have been likely to be one of these women, and was probably an independently wealthy woman, whether through trade or family inheritance, and was not under the authority of a male relative, because she was free to follow Christ as his pupil. Just as the gazelles, which she is named for, can live alone, or they can choose to live in herds, and when they do that, they usually do it for the protection of the young. Interesting, isn't it?
And the other thing that strikes me is upper room would only be had by somebody of some substance.
Yes.
That's right. Nobody else would have an upper room.
No, and if she didn't own it, then she had connections.
Yes, that did.
She had influence that made people go, well, we'll give you an upper room. Nobody would think, oh, she's on the footpath, she's ready for laying out, we'll just trundle her across to number two, we know that upper room's empty. No, you wouldn't.
My Bible says a cool room.
Oh my goodness. They've got a fridge back then.
Great connotation. So I'm just thinking.
Always
so what are the upper rooms cooler? Because, yes. I mean, you wouldn't go to the upper room in this country. Very, very hot.
No, but and maybe the breeze. The sea breeze.
The sea breeze, because of course, it's beside the sea.
Over the wall or something.
Yeah. And the lower room would be a very busy place. That's where everything happens.
Yeah.
Oh, and the animals were in the lower room too. You wouldn't put the corpse there, would you? Not if you wanted a resurrection.
Just
as
the room.
Oh, okay.
We know neither. Oh, so where did I get to? Oh, yeah. Because she's located in Joppa, it's likely that her wealth is from trade as a merchant. If she was an importer-exporter of cloth, and especially purple cloth, she would be well able to provide for the poor. But unless she had trained successors, the business and its profits would cease with her death. And I think that's the significance of needing the resurrection. So with whom did Joppa trade? This turned out to be a really important question to ask myself, because Joppa's main trading partner for many hundreds and hundreds of years had been and was still Tyre. Where they spoke Greek, of course. The Greeks had invaded Tyre before the Romans, but you know how language, the Greek would tended to be the language of the elite still. They admired Greek culture, the way the elite in the days of the British Empire still thought French was rather wonderful and learnt French. Yes. And Tyre was known as the main exporter of purple from the Murex sea snails, which were apparently abundant there, and of purple cloth and clothing. It would not have been uncommon for merchants and traders to go between those two cities and even on to other towns purveying their goods. Tyre had long close ties with Israel because King David and King Hiram of Tyre were trading partners, and the Old Testament record tells us King Hiram also agreed to provide the goods and services to King Solomon on the grounds of his father's David's trustworthiness and fair dealing. We are told that Hiram had huge respect for David throughout their lifetimes. King Hiram provided the timber for the temple, which David imported and stored when Solomon built the temple in Jerusalem, provisioned by Joppa. So they put the logs on board at Tyre, floated them down to Joppa, unloaded them, took them to Jerusalem, and in this weather I wouldn't want that job. Now, the main craftsman for the temple was a man from Dan on the seaboard near Joppa. Israel did eventually conquer Joppa, you see, and that's how it became Israel's main port. It had a very desirable harbour. The man from Dan, also named Hiram, had a mum who was a Hebrew and a dad who was from Tyre. Proof of intermarriage, proselytisation and conversion long before Jesus went there. God gifted this man to work on his temple. Tabitha could also have been of mixed heritage, or she could have been a woman from Tyre, which had been conquered earlier by the Greeks, and she could have sought out Jesus for help and become a lover of Jesus, just as Hiram, king of Tyre, was ever a lover of David. If Tabitha Dorcas was from Tyre and worked in both ports, we might have the reason why no mention is made of her home or any family. We hear that the disciples do everything after her death, but no family is specifically mentioned. We even hear of Christ's family along the way of his preaching, but not of hers. Her family, like that of Hiram's father's family, might be back in Tyre. The theme of admiration and cooperation and love between Tyrians and Hebrews is worth pursuing in relation to Dorcas, because in English her name means gazelle, and as I've said, the gazelle is the symbol of love in the poetry of these areas. It's also a clean animal, a symbol of love and purity in the Song of Songs. And the gazelle has a tan back and a white breast. And when you read Song of Songs, the lover says she is black. Her skin is darkened from pursuing her lover. But her breast is described as white and clean. So it's as if Tabitha is washed clean in the blood of the Lord, and the work she does in charity probably has her looking a bit like Mother Teresa. But the point is, unlike the Pharisees, she was clean on the inside. They were clean on the outside, and with all their with all their rules and regs, and Christ says, you're getting it the wrong way round, you need to be clean on the inside. So, it's made me look at all the Song of Songs, Psalms, Isaiah. It's even if you're not right, it's the pursuit that makes you reread the Bible in different ways, and the point is it does make you read. Because often we go, oh, I don't feel like the readings, but you see, if you've got something prodding you, that's the basic principle of adult learning, isn't it? You learn when you need or want to learn, yes. So, Tyre is specifically mentioned in Psalm 45, which is a song of loves. That reminds us of the Song of Songs, where the gazelle is also used to describe the beauty of the beloved, but it's the beauty of character, isn't it? Psalm 45 is about God's beloved, who is characterized as one who loves righteousness and right standing with God and hates wickedness. Therefore God, his God, has anointed him with the oil of gladness above his fellows. This description is quoted by the writer of Hebrews in chapter 1, verses 8 to 9, who identifies Jesus as this King of righteousness. The psalm is addressed to a king, which Jesus was born to be. In the time when the psalm was written, Tyre was the richest of people. And it was still doing quite nicely when she came along at the time of Jesus. The psalm tells us in the Amplified Version, the daughter of the king of Tyre would entreat the king's, Christ's, favour with a gift or a robe of Tyre. And king's daughters would be among his honourable women and would reverence and honour him because of his righteous character. Jesus was rich in righteousness, not worldly wealth. Were there king's daughters among Christ's followers? Quite possibly. Tyre had been conquered and reconquered like the rest of the areas in the Roman Empire, and there were remnants of Roman houses scattered across the empire and puppet kings, and probably in its slave markets. Because educated people were not always killed off, they were valued for as slaves. They could get you a high price. We know that wealthy, educated, influential women were among his followers. And even the minor daughters of minor kings were educated and worked in the production of goods for trade for the nation. Usually dyed or embroidered cloth. I've known that from Persian history as well. And they worked in the administration of that merchandising. Palaces and women's houses were busy places, often with storehouses nearby. Noble and wealthy women who sought Christ's help for healing would come bearing gifts.
They would sell it.
Yes.
Sell themselves.
And if you want someone to heal you or your child, you don't come empty handed when you're wealthy, do you? And you know he's poor, and you know that the bulk of the people he cares for are poor. Even now, when we were growing up, if you were going to someone's place, you would be told, and buy a tea bun and take it for morning tea. It's that whole, yeah. They would probably want to support Christ's ministry financially, and gifts could be sold to feed and house the company while Jesus ministered to the poor as well. And the poor were possibly the bulk of people who sought his help. Illness and disability eat up finances as well as life. There were many proselytized Jews, such as the Ethiopian eunuch who worked as treasurer for Queen Candace and worshipped at Jerusalem. So proselytizing would be big business for the Jews, and people of all nations have always looked for answers to and help for the difficulties in life. But sometimes the closer we get to the solution, the more dismissive we are of it. A woman from Tyre tracked Christ down, begging him to heal her daughter, but his own people were often dismissive of him. So let's stay with the story of the woman from Tyre a little longer, because it has huge repercussions and ended with a healing session that symbolises the coming death and resurrection of Jesus. A woman from Tyre came begging Jesus, who had journeyed to Tyre, to heal her daughter, and in the process she converted to, in the words of the Amplified Version, worshipping him. She came proclaiming him Messiah of Israel, son of David, at her arrival, and obviously sought him out because she believed his title and ministry. And she honoured him and did obeisance to him on her knees, as predicted in Psalm 45, which means in Eastern terms, kneeling to him with arms outstretched and face bent to the floor. This is the first description of Jesus worshipped as the Messiah. In the Amplified Version, it also says, prayed to. And I thought, how do I feel about this? And then I thought, praying is petitioning. So it's not just, she's petitioning him as the manifestation of God on earth, the representative of God on earth. And I thought, yeah, we've all become a bit edgy because of doctrinal things about, and it's interesting that someone from another nationality can cut straight through the prejudices that the Jews had about someone right. being the Son of God or the Son of... So as you go, you see her elevating and learning in her opinion of him. After Jesus accepted her great faith and healed her daughter, she returned home and he progressed back through Sidon and Tyre along the shores of Galilee and continued way up the mountain and sat and waited and prepared. For what? For the story of the healing of the girl from Tyre to do its work, because he healed her from a distance as well. Spreading like wildfire through Tyre and Sidon and back to Galilee. With what effect? For a great multitude of people from these regions, Jews and Gentiles, to rise up, bringing their sick and disabled with them, and cover the region of Galilee, to break like a tsunami halfway up the mountain with those in need of healing, washed up and delivered to Jesus' feet. And for 3 days he healed them. That is definitely a supernatural phenomenon and a God-empowered performance. It symbolises for us his obeisance to Yahweh and his 3 days in the grave to bring about the salvation of both Jews and Gentiles. And perhaps Tabitha was there. That reminds us of another servant of God who tried to run away from his commission of preaching repentance to the Gentiles of Nineveh, Jonah. And Jonah did a runner from Joppa and spent 3 nights in the belly of the whale. There are more links between Tyre, Joppa, Israel and Sidon, like Elijah and the widow of Zarephath near Sidon, whose son he resurrected in an upper room. And Tyre and Sidon and its surrounding areas are all part of what's called Lebanon. So they really are clumped together. But now I want to look at what it meant to be poor like those healed by Christ, in a seaport in the Roman Empire at the time of Tabitha. So I've got a note to myself saying, dog-eared pages with left-handed writing. Just have to find them back here. Where's my left-handed? That's a bit. Goodness, my eyesight is deteriorating. If I can't spot the left-handed writing, it must be further back. Ah, found it. Do we know whether the yes? Do we know whether the gospel was preached in Tyre? I had asked myself, and that led me to the story of the woman who prayed to Jesus for the healing of her daughter. And then I've got a note about it being conquered by the Greeks and so forth. And then the interesting thing is that this meeting and healing is the only one recorded of Jesus' journey into Tyre. So it can't, that's the only one that would have triggered that movement of people. But why would you hike halfway up a mountain and wait? Well, yes. And it's the only one, therefore, that fulfills the prophecy of Psalm 45 of Jesus being given a Tyrian gift by a king's daughter who entreated his help. Checking whether I... Ah, yeah, there's more left-handed. That's it. So, back to Tabitha's significance. What would her charity have meant, her works of charity, and what particular impact would they have in a port town? We all know we need clean water, food, clothing to survive, as well as shelter. But if you were a widow without wealth or the ability to do trained work in Joppa, feeding, clothing oneself, let alone a small tribe of offspring, could be difficult. If one fell into debt, one could be sold into slavery. And goodness knows where one and one's offspring would end up. If children were orphaned, they could be placed in child farms or camps where they were trained to be slaves. Just have a think about the history of the stolen generation in Australia and ask yourself whether you would like to have been a lousy little sixpence, that was their worth at maximum, in the Aborigine girls' home at Cootamundra. Then ask yourself how you would feel if you were an adult or child without money in Joppa. A little stressed? A tad anxious? A bit fearful perhaps? And hungry? And rather cold in winter? And undernourished? And as an undernourished hypothermic beggar, you'd be a sitting duck for early death by disease. You think, well, would you be able to get food spilt on the docks when ships were loaded and unloaded, or in the marketplaces where some would be sold? Possibly, but then one might have to dodge the slavers and the soldiers to get to it, and one's appearance would not be the sleek, well-fed appearance of the well-cared for. One would be easy prey for those on the lookout for youths and children without protectors. Nice world, the Roman one. Anyone want a trip back there? I can think of a few parents who'd like a trip back there with their kids so that every time they demanded the latest technology, they could say, we're sending you back to Joppa with letters of introduction to slavers and soldiers. I think it'd be effective. Now hold that thought. Because Yahweh made... Well, you see, back in Isaiah, Yahweh got very angry with Israel because people with certain problems were selling children, God's children, for wine. And even for a pair of sandals. No wonder Israel finally ended up under Roman rule. So what was Tabitha doing? In a sense, she was buying back the poor for Yahweh. But we'll go back into that a little later. Since I've referred to Isaiah, no, I don't need to do that because I've already done it. Now, I think I was meant to stop back there, but anyway. Back through to where the last lot of writing was. So if we think the record of Tabitha is too short for her to be important, we do have some food for thought. And I did have a... Oh. She's their benefactor and possibly leader. She qualifies for the rare honour of resurrection because she's essential to the survival of the church, especially its poor, and the poor in Joppa in general, not just in the church. And a further interesting fact is that in the record in Acts, her resurrection by Peter is followed by his commission for God to baptize a Gentile, Cornelius. Peter doesn't balk at performing a resurrection. In fact, he hurried back with them. But he needs a lot of convincing to baptize a Gentile. I think Tabitha Dorcas was converted under Christ's tutelage because I think she's the link between the Gentiles who became proselyte Jews through encounters with Jesus and then became baptized into him, and Gentiles who haven't converted to Judaism, but after the resurrection of Jesus don't have to. They're baptized directly into Christ. So I do think there's a significance in the placement of the story. No one can prove it, but it's worth considering because I've always wondered whether people who were Gentiles had to do the formal process for converting to Judaism if they accepted Jesus when he was alive. Just the same as when he healed people, he would say, go show yourself to the priest and pay the temple. So that's always, I've always had trouble fitting how the process changed. And I think Tabitha could be the link that shows us that while Christ was alive, people probably still were doing a formal conversion process. And also the difference for the disciples between somebody converting in the presence of Jesus, because Jesus took the responsibility for their conversion. He approved it. He accepted it. But for Peter, to be told to go and baptize a man who is a Gentile directly into Christ, that's a real stumbling block. Mm-hmm. So it shows you that this learning process isn't an easy one, is it? It's like when the disciples said to Jesus, why couldn't we heal that person? They often have to get him to do a healing. So it's interesting to consider the two stories together and see the learning process for Peter, because we know for Peter, the law was held in such esteem that he could be convinced by the Jews to separate from them when Christian Jews and Gentiles were together, and Paul had to say to him, no, that isn't right. So I think this story actually has implications for the surrounding text of Acts 2.
You think Peter would have known Dorcas then?
I do. I think in a number of versions it says that when he healed her, she sat up and looked at him. And it doesn't say that of other healings, like Christ healed Jairus' daughter. She was their only daughter. So if she died, there went provision for their old age. If she lived, she could marry and provide for them. Without her, they're into poverty. The young man from Nain, the widow from Nain, Christ resurrected him because his mother would go straight into poverty and early death, and also he would have been thinking of his own coming crucifixion and burial, and at the cross, as Robin says, he gave his mum into the care of Mary. He was so compassionate and concerned for the survival of those who were right at the bottom. And the third healing he did was, resurrection he did was Lazarus. And that was essential to demonstrate his own coming sacrifice and 3 days in the grave, because his disciples still weren't getting that, and the wider community needed that symbol to relate to. With Paul, he raised Eutychus, who fell from the window because he fell asleep listening to Paul. And if Paul hadn't rushed down and raised him, the enemies of Christianity would have made great work of that to undermine the preaching of the gospel, and the grief of it would have undone Paul's teaching. So that was an essential resurrection. And then there's Tabitha's. And she was essential to her ecclesia and to the Gentile poor as well. So wherever she originated, the resurrection, the record of her death and resurrection has helped me explore the Bible for information and connections, which have given me a different view of Jewish-Gentile relations. All this has happened because I read the story of Tabitha and noticed that the word maid didn't seem right for the context. So I looked up a concordance and off I went. So questioning can be the beginning of learning. Just reading to have our doctrines confirmed won't really bring us into rewarding dialogue with God through the Bible. We don't have to be right. What we have to do is learn, love, and act to follow Jesus. And any investigation that stimulates us in that process has to be positive, surely. Or am I the only one that seems to feel as if she lives on permanently spiritually low charge battery?